There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free, there's a better world to come in, don't you see?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Progressive News Network. Tonight's show is dedicated to the senator who stood up for so many. I'd like to have Renee read a brief statement by Senator Davis.
Misplaced priorities of legislative leaders squandered a tremendous opportunity to make much-needed improvements in our transportation infrastructure and help create good jobs and bring businesses to Texas. Despite urging by responsible members of the Senate to bring up the matter of transportation, Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst derailed as much as $1 billion per year in transportation funding by stubbornly pushing divisive failed legislation attacking women's health care options. If leaders are serious about using this second so-called special session to improve the lives of Texans by repairing and expanding our transportation networks, they will find no greater ally than me. If, however, they intend to keep pushing their extreme personal political agenda ahead of the interests of Texas families, I will not back off on my duty to fight on their behalf. Thank you, Wendy Davis.
Wendy Davis, the senator from Texas who stood up for so many. Many of us were pulling for her. Ladies and gentlemen, we have an interesting show for you tonight. Progressive women leaders from across the state and beyond. Women we can all look up to, leaders in their own right. But first, the news. One of the first stories I want to tell you about is so many of us have been thinking about privacy, security, more than we ever have before. And we're assured again and again that, listen, they're just getting metadata. There's no real listening. There's no really close scrutinization. Well, yeah, sure, they're taking all your email files. They're analyzing all of your downloads. But it's just metadata they're after. And yet we have stories like this. Anti-war activists targeted as domestic terrorists. Shocking new revelations are coming as activists prepare to sue the U.S. military for unlawful spying. Anti-war activists who were infiltrated and spied on by the military for years have now been placed on the domestic terrorist list, they announced Monday. The shocking revelation comes as activists prepare to sue the U.S. military for unlawful spying. The fact that a peaceful activist such as myself is on this domestic terror list should be cause for concern for other people in the U.S., declared Brendan Masklaus Dunn, a plaintiff in the lawsuit. We've seen an increase in the buildup of mass surveillance state under Obama and the Bush administration. The discovery is the latest development in a stunning saga that exposes vast post-9/11 spying networks in which military, police, and federal agencies appear to be the cahoots. Documents declassified in 2009 reveal that military informant John Towery, going by the name John Jacobs, spent over 2 years infiltrating and spying on Olympia, Washington, anti-war and social justice groups, including the Port Militarization Resistance, Student for Democratic Society, the Industrial Workers of the World, and Iraq Veterans Against the War. Towery admitted to the spying and revealed that he shared information with not only the military, but also the police and federal agencies. He claimed that he was not the only spy. Activists who blast snooping as a violation of their First and Fourth Amendment rights levied a lawsuit against the military in 2009. The spying resulted in the plaintiffs and others being targeted for repeated harassment, preemptive and false arrest, excessive use of force, and malicious prosecution, reads a statement by the plaintiffs. When the plaintiffs were preparing for the deposition for the courts 2 weeks ago, they were shocked to discover that several Olympia anti-war activists were listed on the domestic terrorist list, including at least two plaintiffs in the case. The revelation prompted them to amend their lawsuit to include the charges that nonviolent activists were unlawfully targeted as domestic terrorists. Well, you probably already know that if you turn in information about farm animal treatment, now that's also been placed on the domestic terrorist watch list. On a more positive note, photography help is requested. It's criminal. Toxic red and brown tides plague our bays and lagoons. Dangerous blue-green algae ruins our springs and rivers. Exotic invaders choke our lakes and canals. But activists like you can be fighting Florida's slime crime. You've attended rallies, you've signed petitions, you've lobbied, maybe even you've been photographers for the cause. On some fronts, we've been wildly successful. Over 50 local governments have adopted strong urban fertilizer management laws. Local fertilizer controls have been protected from deregulation in 7 legislative sessions in a row. But securing strict limits on the stuff that feeds the slime, fertilizer, sewage, animal manure pollution, for all our beloved Florida water bodies has been an uphill battle. Over the past few years, the EPA has been both friend and foe. Unfortunately for our economy and our quality of life, right now, the EPA is doing its best to give Governor Rick Scott and his polluting industry buddies unfettered freedom to stall desperately needed cleanup action. So this summer, while the red and green tides and a toxic slime hits us the hardest, we're fighting back. We've been gathering photos, proof of Florida's slimy problem, since 2011, and we've been asking you once more to join the fight with camera in hand. Chances are you're not far from a toxic algae outbreak, no matter where you live in Florida during the summer. We need photos of that ugly algae, a picture that speaks 1,000 words. Can you use your phone or camera to capture the slime you find this summer? It's super easy to send them, and they'll be put to good use. They'll go on to fight our slime crime tracker map. This is from Chris Costello of the Sierra Club. So just go online after you take your pictures, and you'll be able to upload them to the Sierra Club. Another story that's important, Warren's loan bill gets the cold shoulder, and tomorrow the student interest rates will spike. Oddly enough, while Republicans can certainly take their share of blame, our good friends in the Democratic Party did not stand up with the brave Senator Warren, and her vote, her bill to lower the interest rates, to keep them holding and not increase, was not supported by any Democrats in the Senate. So let your senators know. I think we have one here that occasionally votes Democratic. Another story. CIA rebuffs Congress on torture findings. The CIA is expected to deliver a report to senators on Thursday that rebuffs the congressional probe into the agency's interrogation methods. CIA Director John Brennan is slated to deliver the CIA's contradictory findings to the Senate Intelligence Committee Chairwoman Dianne Feinstein, Democrat of California, and Ranking Member Saxby Chambliss of Georgia. In a private meeting on Thursday, the senator said, "The CIA's report challenges the findings of the Intelligence Committee that concluded the enhanced interrogation techniques were ineffective in gathering intelligence. It's interesting to me that it's in the newspapers before we have a chance to discuss it," Feinstein told reporters Thursday. Evidently, the CIA has a leak. Feinstein Intelligence Committee completed its long-awaited 6,000-page torture report last December and sent it to the administration and intelligence officials for a declassification review. The report looked at more than 6 million pages of CIA and intelligence documents, with investigators ultimately issuing a series of 20 findings and conclusions. The committee's report criticizes the effect that interrogation techniques such as waterboarding and extended sleep deprivation have on the ability to gather successful and reliable intelligence. President Obama banned the use of controversial interrogation techniques as one of his first acts in the White House. Some Republicans and intelligence officials argue that the president wouldn't have been able to order the killing of Osama bin Laden without the intelligence that techniques produced during the George W. Bush administration. Democrats have waged an extensive battle against this controversial interrogation method. They said they were misled about the use of tactics and argue they amount to torture and violate international war laws. The Bush administration argued the methods, which were used in self-professed 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, among others, were within the law and helped U.S. intelligence officials disrupt terror plots against the United States. There's more news available. If you go to averyvoice.com, you can see the full text of all these news stories we want to bring. Another on the pollution front, how Shell Oil is trying to send a chill through the activist groups across the country. This is jointly authored by Phil Radford and Ben Jealous. One of the most important rights as Americans is the freedom to express ourselves. It takes the form of voting. It takes the form of activism. It takes the form of our First Amendment rights to free speech. This summer, the Ninth Circuit Court in California is weighing the question of whether companies have the right to take preemptive legal action against peaceful protesters for hypothetical future protests. This will be an extraordinary decision that could have significant impact on every American's First Amendment rights. In this case, Shell Offshore Inc., versus Greenpeace was filed by the Shell Oil Company last summer. Shell assumed, based on conjecture, that Greenpeace USA would protest the company's drilling in the Alaskan Arctic. Shell asked the Ninth Circuit Court for a preemptive injunction and restraining order against Greenpeace USA. Despite Greenpeace's appeal, the court granted the injunction for the entire duration of the drilling period, a decision which effectively gave a federal blessing to the company's wish to do its controversial work in secret. There'll be more news later, but now, Renee Shaker, associate producer.
Thanks, Rick. As you know, the Supreme Court just ended its season, and again, with one major exception, it was an unmitigated victory for conservatives, sadly. That one major exception, of course, is striking down the Defense of Marriage Act. And that was in United States versus Windsor. We congratulate Edith Windsor in her bravery in taking on this issue and the fact that she will not have to pay, and in fact will get a refund for the government for the estate taxes she had to pay because the federal government did not recognize her marriage. So, again, congratulations, Edith Windsor. And then in a related issue, Hollingsworth versus Perry, the court declined to decide a case from California on Proposition 8. What this does, it effectively allows same-sex marriages to stand in California, and it basically punted overall on the issue of same-sex marriage. So the fights will still continue at the state level. On a rather compromise issue for civil rights, Fisher versus University of Texas, Austin, the court affirmed affirmative action in a 7-1 decision. Basically, it affirmed its 2003 decision in Grutter versus Bollinger that explicitly allowed race to be a factor in admissions decisions as long as it is not the determining factor. On the face of it, it does seem to be a victory for affirmative action, but once again, the court took a very narrow ruling and leaves open the possibility of future rulings against affirmative action down the road. And then, of course, in the major disappointment, we had Shelby versus Holder, where the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act is unconstitutional. Just for a bit of clarity, Section 4 is the formula that the government uses in determining which states are subject to the Voting Rights Act. Because this has been struck down, Congress basically forced back to Congress to update the formula, which, as we know, and I'm sure they know, is not likely to happen, at least not with this Congress. And there's also a host of other decisions. Again, victories for companies, developers, and for the conservatives in general. In Koontz versus St. John's River Water Management District, there was a legal blow struck to sustainable development that will have long-lasting harm for American communities. The ruling creates a perverse incentive for municipal governments to reject applications from developers rather than attempt to negotiate projects that might advance both public and private goals. And it makes it harder for communities to get property owners to pay to mitigate any environmental damage that they may cause. In Mutual Pharmaceutical versus Bartlett, justices in a 5-4 ruling say generic drug makers are not liable for drugs that are a faulty design. The decision is a victory for the generic drug industry, but further narrows the recourse for people who are harmed by such drugs. In Vance versus Ball State University, in which an African-American worker accused her supervisor of racial harassment, the court held that the person she accused was a coworker and not a supervisor. a distinction that requires a higher burden of proof for the plaintiff's employer to be found liable. In American Express versus Italian Colors Restaurant, there was another blow to class action. The Supreme Court continued its aggressive effort to favor corporations by forcing customers to raise grievances through individual arbitration rather than class action or some other joint legal challenge. And then the final one that I'll bring up is Salinas versus Texas, where the right to remain silent, the court ruled that a suspect's failure to answer a police officer's questions before an arrest may be used against that suspect at trial. Justice Stephen Breyer, joined by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan, in a dissent, said allowing a prosecutor to comment on a defendant's constitutionality-protected silence would put that defendant in an impossible predicament, torn between discrimination through speech and incrimination through silence. So basically what we've seen, Rick, in all these cases is that whenever there is a victory for civil rights, the court has taken a very narrow interpretation and ruled on only the specifics of that particular issue at hand. But when ruling for conservative causes, it tends to take a more wide-ranging and blanket approach. Interesting to see what's going to come up next year.
It certainly is. While we wait for our first guest to come on, let me go ahead and talk about another interesting story in the news. It seems that when residents of Fukushima were invited to return to their former homes, the first question they wanted to ask their government was, well, you promised to clean it up. Has it been cleaned up? And the government said, well, no, we're going to count on you to keep yourselves safe, but we will issue you dosimeters so you can tell how radioactive you are. And the local people from Fukushima said, well, we don't want dosimeters to tell us how poisoned we are. We want you to clean it up. And they said, well, that's what you get. You get dosimeters, not a clean environment. Another interesting story is this one. The waters leaking from the Fukushima reactor are now within just 6 meters of the Pacific. Tokyo Electric Power said Saturday it's detected high levels of radioactive substances, including strontium, emitting beta rays in groundwater, taken from a well at the port of the Fukushima's number one nuclear plant. TEPCO said that 3,000 becquerels of radioactive substances per liter were recorded in groundwater from the well located just 6 meters from the Pacific. That concentration is only 100 times higher than the maximum legal limit, as levels of radioactive tritium have been rising in seawater across the port. Radioactive substances are suspected to have leaked into the ocean. It's true that radioactive contamination has been found from groundwater near the sea, but we don't know whether tainted water has made its way into the Pacific, a TEPCO official said. Contamination found in the water sample was collected Friday. The well is the nearest to the shore among the four wells used for observation purposes at the plant. According to TEPCO, irradiation levels from the groundwater were also the highest ever detected. Also Friday, TEPCO recorded 1,400 becquerels of beta ray emitting radioactive substances such as strontium in groundwater from another well situated 25 meters from the sea. The latest revelations came after readings of tritium and strontium 90 were found to be 8 to 30 times higher than the perceptible limit in groundwater from that well in May. After that discovery, TEPCO expanded the area that it surveys and drilled an additional observation well nearer to the Pacific. Over the last months, levels of radioactive tritium in seawater near the well intakes of Reactor 1 and 4 at the crippled nuclear complex soared to 1,500 becquerels per liter at one point. A member of the Nuclear Regulatory Authority earlier said it's highly likely that contaminated groundwater has leaked into the Pacific. Following the triple meltdown at Fukushima No. 1 plant, huge amounts of highly radioactive water gushed into the Pacific through a duct containing cables for Reactor 2, one of the three wrecked units. TEPCO sealed the duct in April of 2011, but some of the remaining tainted water is believed to have leaked and become mixed with the groundwater, said the officials at the utility. Another nuclear-related story. 27 years later, radiation still hides out in Chernobyl's trees, Fukushima 2. April 26, 1986, meltdown at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant scattered radioactive material across 58,000 square miles of Eastern Europe. In a ring 18 miles from the destroyed plant, authorities set up the Chernobyl exclusion zone, a place where no one is supposed to live, although, of course, some do. Scientific American is a story of how, through the disaster took place decades ago, radiation persists in a huge area around the defunct power plant, ready to be re-released into the environment. And now, ladies and gentlemen, our first guest has arrived. Let me welcome Vice President Meredith Ochman of Florida National Organization for Women. Welcome, Meredith.
Hi, Rick. Thank you so much for having me back. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome, my dear. Well, you've completed your presidency at Palm Beach now. Now your wonderful leadership can be focused at the Florida level, and I'm sure beyond. You've got many projects going on. Tell us, Meredith. Tell Renee and I, what are you up to these days?
Hi, Renee. So I'm working on five different organizations right now. Of course, I'm coming to you from Florida now, which is my home. I'm the vice president of Florida now. I'm also working with the National Women's Political Caucus, where we focus on getting women elected and pro-choice candidates elected because there's not equal representation at this point. I'm also working with the South Florida Women's Health Foundation, where we do work to subsidize the cost of birth control for women who can't afford it. And I'm also working with a group called Soho Dogs, I'm vice president of this new nonprofit, and it's a nonprofit organization where we use the care of the dogs in particular, in a rescue for therapy for veterans, particularly with PTSD. And, of course, I'm also helping with the Inner Truth Project. So I'm a little – I have a few projects on my hands.
Yeah. You know, no one can say to you, geez, you know, Meredith, why don't you make something happen in this town, you know? Thank you so much. There's also so much in the news right now. I know no one's thoughts have been far from the recent Supreme Court decisions. What was your first blush reaction to that?
Well, you know, I've been an activist in this town for 25 years. I've been an activist on this particular issue of equal rights for the LGBT community for at least 15 of those 25 years. And I can tell you my first reaction, my solid reaction to this is that this is just the another major step in moving us forward to full equality, and I believe we're going to see that. It's monumentous, but it threw me back entirely, and I could not be happier with the way that they handled, particularly DOMA.
You know, you're a person who literally works every day for equitable treatment for people. And while on the one hand, this is a wonderful decision, finally, no activist can be happy, I think, about the decision on the voting rights issue. How far does one have to look to see the problem?
There's people within our communities who've been mistreated as far as the voting rights issue. You know, that's really it's going to be a tremendous challenge to try and get around that problem of making sure that people have everything they need to go in and make and have the ability to vote. You know, the upside is I believe that the efforts that the conservatives made in this past election cycle to try and limit the amount of voting just galvanized the people on the right side of history to make sure that they did show up at the polls. So we will find a way to get people there and to make sure that they have the ability to vote. You know, I don't think that's going to put anybody down. I just think it's going to be a bigger challenge, and we have a lot of work to do.
Meredith, let's come back to the good news for a moment with DOMA. But then there was the other issue of Proposition 8 in California,
mm-hmm.
and the court declined
right.
to take that issue up and rule on the validity or invalidity of Proposition 8. So it basically mm-hmm. got kicked back down. Were you disappointed at the narrowness, or what do you see on Proposition 8 going forward? Is it basically dead?
I'm always cautiously optimistic when I you consider any of the challenges that they may bring. But if you noticed, I don't know if you saw this, but the people that were against equal marriage rights just tried to put another obstacle in the way of the ruling that the Supreme Court just came down with, and they just got they got blown off as well today. So I see that standing. I don't think we have anything to worry about. You know, it's less enthusiastic than I would have liked to see the ruling come down, but I think it's the best that we could expect of this scenario at this point.
Especially from this court.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was reading recently that the Obama administration reaffirmed its insistence on having birth control covered in the Affordable mm-hmm. Care Act, and that
mm-hmm.
there was this came out of a ruling out of the United States Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit, where Hobby Lobby, a craft store chain, described itself
mm-hmm.
as a faith-based company to try to get exemption.
Right.
Can you tell us anything about that?
Well, you know, I don't have a lot of details on that particular case, but I know that as far as Hobby Lobby is concerned, I know that they had brought this case up, and that they had been obviously I have the same information that you did, but that you mentioned. But I know that the Obama administration has been very supportive of the pro-choice community, and he even made an appearance at the Planned Parenthood convention this year, which is the first time I know of that a sitting president has done that. So, you know, I know that we have a lot of support from this administration as far as that's concerned, and I'm very pleased that birth control is not limited as far as the over the counter anymore as well. And I don't know if you guys were paying attention to that Supreme Court ruling, but it's no longer limited as to who can get birth control over the counter too.
Yes. Yes. That.
So it's it's just. Go ahead.
Go ahead. Go ahead. Finish with your thought.
No, I mean it's just another example of how supportive this administration has been, and just a really great opportunity to show the solidarity and the fact that they're standing up for the right thing to do.
You know, I have to ask you also about that amazing, amazing stand taken by Senator Davis in Texas. So many of us were thrilled. I have to admit, mm-hmm. maybe it was turnabout obstructionism, but to
yeah.
see a strong, forceful advocate under those incredible, tight rules,
mm-hmm.
it just, I think, made all of us proud. What was your reaction to the Senator Davis issue?
So, of course, I was awake and watching the whole time. And there's a few things that I think are really interesting. And first of all, she's an amazing individual. I think she's done so much with her life, and she's done so much to really make us proud. In this particular issue, she stood up for us, and she did just an incredible job I have to say my initial reaction was to call her office and thank her profusely for having done the work that she did, and she just really, really did the right thing. What's interesting is that the conservatives in that state, the leadership in that state, when the time clock was running out, about 15 to 20 minutes before the clock ran out, they stopped her, and they were going to try and take a vote. They were going to try and have a discussion and take the vote, and the activists in the galley were just not going to have it. So when they had stopped her from being able to filibuster, the activists made enough noise until midnight to make sure that they didn't have the opportunity to take that vote, which I think was just, you know, all around, it was just a phenomenal day in Texas and the way that they handled that. Unfortunately, you know, I think long term we're going to see that challenge. We're going to see them come back. They've already called another special session that's starting, I believe, tomorrow. And we're going to, you know, it's going to be a challenge to maintain that momentum that we had there. So I don't know where that's going to go.
Well, let's hope that there are more Democrats in Texas. Although Democrats in Texas seems like a hard thing to say. Just phenomenal, just phenomenal. So of the issues that you've got in your foreground right now, it's hard to say in a five-plate special what you're having first, but what's the most critical thing you're working on right now?
So right now there's a couple of things. Just as an aside, you know, one of the things I'm working on personally on behalf of now is this, you know, this past session we had an alimony reform bill that that passed in the House and the Senate was vetoed by the governor, and we had opposed it from a now perspective because of some of the parts of the alimony reform bill. There's still parts that we're trying to get some information about, and we're trying to do the right thing for all women and men too, but for all people on that issue. So it's still something that's at the forefront. And of course, you know, the other and more, most importantly at this point, the DOMA ruling and the Prop 8 ruling. So, you know, we're all thrilled about it, and we know that this is such an incredible step and such a great move. But a lot of people came to me afterwards from across the state asking me what it actually means for us and what it actually means going forward. So what we're going to be doing from a now perspective, we're going to be putting together town hall meetings across the state to discuss what the actual ramifications and positive ramifications are of DOMA. And the next step is going to be to work with the gay and lesbian community to make sure that we overturn the Florida amendment that had gone in. It's the Florida version of DOMA, and that went through, I believe, in 2008. So we have a lot of work to do in Florida. Just because DOMA was struck down and Prop 8 was not ruled on doesn't mean that we're free and clear in the state of Florida. We have a lot of work to do. So I encourage your listeners to please contact me or contact me through Florida Now to make sure that they're part of the solution and that they stay on top of this. It's very important. You know, and I heard somebody mention this, and I think it was brilliantly put, that a marriage is not between two people. It's not a commitment between two people, but a commitment between two families. And so, you know, if you consider that, you know that all people in a family are affected by the marriage of two people and by the, you know, and it, you know, it makes a big difference to ensure that we have supportive, that we support all the way around. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important.
Meredith, why don't you give our listeners your web address and how they can find you?
Oh, okay. They can definitely go to, it's FL, like Florida, FLNOW.org. I'm fine to put out my personal email address is Meredith, that's meredith.ockman. And that's at gmail.com. And if they, you know, be patient with me, I get a lot of emails every day. So
okay.
I'll get to everything.
Well, is this where you'll be posting the town hall meetings?
We're going to put it on Facebook as well, and floridanow.org. I'm sorry, the Florida Now Facebook, and I'll put it on my Facebook page. I believe at least I've started putting together a coalition partners in Palm Beach County, at least, so that we can address that in Palm Beach County, and I know that Equality Florida is going to be advertising it with us as well.
Well,
we work
I know
closely
you'll...
with them.
I was just going to say, I know you'll let us know what those.
Yeah,
I know you'll
course.
Let us know what those dates are.
Of course, absolutely. As a matter of fact, on Wednesday when we had the ruling come down, we had already prepped and planned with all the LGBT groups in Palm Beach County and some groups that are supporters in Palm Beach County. We had about 100 people show up at the on the day of the announcement. In downtown West Palm Beach, just because we called for it, and it came down like immediately, we got the message out to everybody. So we have a really good, strong message base that we can go through, and we'll get the word out. Everybody will know about it.
That's great. That's wonderful news, Meredith. And we applaud all the great work you're doing. I have a bazillion questions. I would love to keep you on the show for the next hour or so, but we have our next guest on, Debbie Frazier. She's with the United Straight and Gay Alliance. Debbie, are you with us?
I am with you.
Wonderful to have you. Obviously, this is a historic week for all of us and your organization. Why don't you give us your reactions, what your group is doing, what you're working on, and where you see the next fights and efforts?
Well, I wanted to say hi to Rick, too. Hey, Rick, how are you?
Very good, very
my
good.
Friend.
And I think Meredith's going to Meredith just left. Thanks again, Meredith. But go ahead, Deb.
What is historic, yes, but I think we've made historic steps for so long that this is kind of like the, the cream of the top. But, we do have a lot of work going ahead. But I'm just really very thankful and very blessed to feel that we've gotten this far. I was pretty excited about it, obviously. And, I kind of like to stay in this moment for a little bit. Of course, we have a lot of work to do. But, I think it's important to feel grateful for what we've accomplished, too.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a tremendous amount of work by a lot of great people. And I think that a time out to pat yourself on the back is more than deserved right now. But you do mention future fights. Where do you see the next issues and what is your group doing?
Well, actually, I think there's different aspects of this. Obviously, the legal aspect of it, and all Doman Prop 8 in the Supreme Court has just been the legal aspects of it. And our right to love has never been the question. I believe is a God-given right. It's our right to have the legal sanctions that all the straight people have in their marriages. But I also believe that in my group, we're very big into outreach with different communities. We're actually involved pretty heavily now with the Hispanic community and the Black community. I'm working with the Hispanic Caucus and the Black Caucus and Florida Alliance of Retired Americans. We can't do this by ourselves. And there's no one that you ask that does not have someone that they know and care about that is not in the gay community. So I think it's very important that, we applaud those people, too, that have come out there because we've never would have been able to do it without them. And, for everyone that has, stood on their front porch and talked to their neighbors and, has taken a stand somewhere and not dropped hands when they were standing with their partners or the person that they love, or even the person that they're dating, and it doesn't necessarily have to be someone that they love. So I think everyone, actually, even you guys, people that have stood with us or have evolved, which is very important right now too. And a lot of people are kind of, they don't necessarily want to bring that up, but I think it's amazing when somebody says, "Hey, look, 2 years ago, I did not understand it, but because of you guys and because of hearing stories and seeing things, you know, for ourselves, that we have evolved. And I think that's amazing.
It is.
Debbie, if I can ask you a quick question. I know you've been involved with young people as well. And even though, you know, a teenager is not, is probably not thinking about marriage in the immediate future, I think that there's probably a good case that can be made that just seeing this societal approval is going to have its repercussions on the younger gay community, younger GLBT community. It's going to help them, I think, feel a little better too. Is that your feeling?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I'm 53, and, I'm happy. I'm excited. You know, when I walk out, the day after this all came down, I had someone look at me when I was getting a cup of coffee and said, point blank, people like you make me sick to look at. I about fell out in the floor because I had a United Straight and Gay Alliance polo shirt on. And I was just shocked, absolutely. And I had to wait a minute and, you know, came back and said, look, you know, we just had to clear that God's name that you used to punish us, you know. And it's like, and look, you know, we're happy here. You know, we can love. You know, it is legal now. And, you know, and of course the next day I had somebody say how excited they were that, you know, we were standing up and that we got the rights. But like I said, people got to realize this is never about the right to love. You know, they cannot take that away from us. So the legal aspect of it, you know, as hokey as it may sound, I've always said love will win. You know, that hope will always outlast, that we'll always stand the ground, and that we will, I won't say we win, it's not like a win-win thing, but it's like, you know, we will win. But it's the point that it's just, you know, I can't stand the thought that these kids, you know, have had to live, you know, in the shelters. But it's not just gay kids, and like Ricky and I've talked about, it's also children of gay people that are also, or the parents of gay people. So this has not just affected us, ourselves. This has affected, you know, everyone around us, and the collateral damage is just amazing. But I agree. I think these kids are going to, I know we've all actually got a second breath on this.
Well, Debbie, there's no doubt that we're on the right side of history on this issue. And like so many monumental social issues, it takes a long time to drag the rest of the country along. What's the lay of the land here in Florida? What are the issues you're looking at here locally?
Well, locally, I mean, you know, the Amendment 4 back in 2010 outlawed marriage in the state of West Virginia. I mean, state of West Virginia, so where I'm from the state of Florida. You know, we are going to have a very strong political fight. But this is nothing really new to us. We may have, quote unquote, rejuvenated the base of the Christian, which I'm a Christian, which really drives me crazy that, you know, it's Christians against non-Christians when I am, but I'm gay. So, you know, when you get people that, you know, really are just so, so bigoted about, you know, their feelings or whatever, yeah, we can't fool ourselves. This is not going to be an easy thing to do. But you have so many people in this state that are strong leaders, and not just gay leaders, you know, gay community leaders. These are leaders in all the communities that are saying, look, we can do this as long as we stick together. You know, they don't understand this isn't the straights against the gays anymore. You know, this isn't the black against the white. We've all come to a realization that we really are all in this. So I really believe that I really think it's just a matter of time. I'm really content. I'm ready to go.
I'll just think
that. Yeah, well, and I think we've kind of rejuvenated a lot of people on our side that may have been like, oh, I don't know, you know, I don't know if it's worth fighting for. But when they see how this affects everybody, I think people really, we have a lot of progressive people in this state. I have many, 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 many friends all throughout the state. You know, I'm on the Democratic Florida caucus, the LGBT caucus. So, you know, we have people all through the state We're all very close within our party in the state. I really think that, you know, I really think we're going to do this, and I'm not sure exactly how we are going to handle this, but I would say that somewhere along the way, we will all probably be getting together to have end up having like a ballot initiative.
Deb, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
How has it been regarding, you know, whether it be county employees or state employees with benefits, or how are, have you seen or heard stories about, you know, hospital access for couples? You know, what are you seeing in terms of the lay of the land locally?
Well, you know, with municipalities, yeah, and it's municipalities. You know, we have, like, Rand Hawk with the Human Rights Palm Beach County. You know, he's a big advocate for going out and doing municipalities. I know we're in a site down in Boca right now with, I'm not exactly that trap. As much as I'm part of the politics of it, I try to stay out of the legal issues, like the in-depth legal issues. But it's a municipal thing, you know, and the more progressive, obviously, the area is, the more that we tend to have equality. But, you know, there's so many – I just think President Obama should just come in and do an executive order, and we'll just go right along in the civil rights. You know, we'll be protected. I mean, we should be. We should be protected under the civil rights, I think. You know, because what, now we can get married, but we know we can still be fired? Or, you know, what kind of support is that to tell your partner, look, honey, we can get married, this is great, and I got you, and you know what, you can get my Social Security, but guess what, I can still get fired from my job, and I can still get thrown out of our place, and we can't go to the local restaurant because they can throw us out. I mean, it's, we still have a long way to go, but like I said, I'm still very happy where we are, and I think we should take this moment and really kind of regroup, get rejuvenated, be recharged, and we're ready to go.
Let me ask you, Deb. I know a law is not going to change people's hearts. However,
right.
from a very practical standpoint, do you think this decision will provide you with any political help, maybe give cover to people who on this issue who would otherwise be more reluctant to take a stand?
You mean with the Supreme Court? Would it help?
Here in Florida, politically,
mm-hmm.
The fact that, you know, the Supreme Court has ruled on this, and let's face it, you know, politicians are political animals, and regardless of what's in their hearts. Do you think the Supreme Court decision would help your organization and your cause here on the political level, legislatively?
I honestly believe that, you know, I got into a fight with Alan West and got thrown out of his town hall one time because my daughter asked about what he thought about gay marriage. And he was like, hey, take it up with your state. They don't think it's right, so therefore it shouldn't be right. So when people use the law as a platform, they tend to hang us if it does not go toward their way. So, I mean, when it goes their way that they're thinking. Right now, when these walls start falling down, I do. I think that they're going to, you know, I think the perspectives and the aspect of that with certain people are going to be like, well, you know, what are you going to do? But you're always going to have people fight us. You're always going to have people fight. It's just like you're always going to have racism. You know, you're always going to have that. And that doesn't really going to change that much with the law. That's why we try so hard to reach across with communities and do it that way and say, hey, look, we're here with you. What can we do to help you too? And then they see, you know, that we're not the three-headed, you know, crazy people out here being, you know, whatever. They know that we care about them, and they see us, and that is the difference, because you can change all the laws in the world, and that's great, and it's awesome, and that's what we want to do. But when we do that, we're only halfway there.
Sure, sure. Are there any activities or meetings or any events that you guys have coming up that our listeners might be interested in? Or how can our audience? Go ahead.
Actually, you can go to www.unitedsaga.org. That's our page, and you can contact me there, or you can contact me at Debbie dot.fraser@unitedsaga.org. And what we'll do is, I know, you know, like anyone, when we gather our leaders and collectively stand together with this, because we are a minority, you know, we will come out of this very soon as a very, very strong coalition, like Meredith was talking about. You know, we work with so many different organizations, and we know enough now that when we do come out to you know, try to rally around this, we need to come out together. So I think we're all going to be much, much stronger when we work together.
Of course.
Well, Deb, thanks so much for joining us. We salute the work that you're doing. I see you out there all the time, and you support so many good causes. Why don't you go ahead and give the folks your contact information one more time?
Okay. It is, you can contact us at www.unitedsaga.org.
Great.
And, yeah, and like I said, look, Vera, I'd say within a month, we will definitely be doing the coalitions because we're ready. We need to roll out of here very strong and very unified because, you know, we're going to have a little fight on our hands. But we're good. We're ready.
Thanks so much, Deb. Sure appreciate you joining us.
All right, thanks.
Thank you, Debbie.
All right, thank you so much. All right, bye-bye.
You know, so many of us have been aware whether it be from the Manning case, the Assange case, the Snowden case now, that there are whistleblowers who've been trying to let Americans know just how much their privacy has been abused. And we have next up a woman activist, a progressive leader, a woman who's been very involved in helping people keep some shred of privacy in their online life. I'd like to introduce Dr. Catherine Albrecht. Hello there, ladies and gentlemen. This is Rick Spezak, News Director of Progressive News Network. I want to welcome you to another adventure with Progressive News Network. Today we're going to be interviewing Dr. Catherine Albrecht, a privacy expert, award-winning author, broadcaster. She's also a Christian prophecy speaker and a breast cancer survivor. She's authored legislation, testified before the FTC and lawmakers around the globe. She's written for Scientific American, granted over 2,000 media interviews to the New York Times, NPR, Today Show, Coast to Coast AM, CBS Evening News, to name just a few. Dr. Albrecht was also appointed by the New Hampshire Governor, John Lynch, to serve as an expert member of the state's two-year RFID commission. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Albrecht.
Program this morning. How are you?
Very good. Thank you, Dr. Albrecht. We want to welcome you to the show. You are such an interesting person, obviously a person who has thought long and deeply about many issues, but we're here first and foremost to talk about privacy and your interest in personal privacy and personal information security. Dr. Albrecht, why don't you talk to us a little bit about how you were alerted or the issue became foremost in your mind about how we can have some privacy in this interconnected world of that we live in today. Could you talk a little about how you got interested in the subject?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, Richard, privacy, I've been working on this issue since 1999 as a privacy advocate. I actually got started fighting supermarket frequent shopper cards, which the majority of Americans have no idea how that is creating a vast food registration system, not only in the U.S. but across the entire globe. People get worried about, you know, their guns being registered and taken away from them. They need to probably think about their food being registered and taken away, because we're actually seeing that happen in Venezuela now, where the shopper cards are being used to literally prevent you from buying food. Even if you go to multiple stores, they limit you to X amount of bread per week, and you can't exceed that, and you have to ID yourself and register the food. And we're all doing that already with these frequent shopper cards. 2003, I became aware of a technology called RFID, or radio frequency identification, and the fact that some of the biggest corporations on the globe were making plans to secretly embed these devices that are essentially tracking devices into all of the consumer products sold across the globe. As they put it, everything from jumbo jets to sewing needles would contain its own unique ID number and be remotely trackable. So, ick. I found out about that. I launched a consumer privacy group actually in 1999 called Caspian, Consumers Against Supermarket Privacy Invasion and Numbering. And since that time, of course, my interests have expanded far beyond the supermarkets, but I still have definitely a heart for retail issues and the things people buy and sell. And the reason for that is because when I was a little girl, my grandmother sat me down and told me that there would be a time when you would not be able to buy and sell unless you had a number, and that number would be on your right hand or your forehead. And, of course, I'm referring there to the prophetic book of Revelation that talks about the mark of the beast that will come about in the dark times as we kind of get the world taken over. So a lot of that seems like it's unfolding as we speak. We've got now numbered payment systems that even when I was a little girl, I couldn't even figure how you could pay with a number. I'd never seen a credit card. There weren't cash registers with computers in them. There was no internet, no satellite uplinks. None of this stuff existed. So it's pretty extraordinary that in those 20, 30 years or so since I was a girl, actually 34 years now, I guess, since I was a girl, things have really progressed very quickly. In 2007, we put an end to the chipping of human beings with implantable microchips, which was a great coup. You can learn all about that if you go to antichips.com and chipmenot.com. We've got the story up there of how that occurred. Back in 2007, those same implantable microchips they wanted to put into products, they were putting them into humans. They were injecting them into Alzheimer's patients in Florida, patients as part of a Blue Cross Blue Shield trial. Diabetic patients were getting injected with these chips. It was awful. And we revealed the story. I actually kind of was a whistleblower. I guess I wasn't on the inside, but I can relate to Ed Snowden right now because I worked for 6 months quietly behind the scenes with the Associated Press reporter Todd Lewin to break that story that those microchips cause cancer. And when we broke that story, published academic research articles and medical journal articles showing that these implants cause cancer, we were able to stop pretty much stop all of that in its tracks. The people got their microchips removed. The company's stock value went from $11 a share to 25 cents a share, and they were delisted from the stock exchange. That's the Verichip Corporation, or they go by a bunch of different names. They used to be Digital Angel, and what they call themselves now. But we got them stopped, and then in 2009, I realized that while I was focusing on all of these physical tracking methodologies and techniques, that the online tracking had become completely out of control. In 2009, I became aware that Google was essentially not a search engine, but a market research company. And not only just a market research company, but a market research company that was working for the government. And a great example of how this came to my attention, I had used Google for our best-selling book on RFID called Spy Chips, published in 2006. My co-author, Liz McIntyre, and I had done all of our research on Google, as does everybody else in the country. We didn't even think twice about it. And then in 2009, I learned that Google makes a record of every single thing that we search for, and that because they make those records, they know everything. I mean, they know what people had for dinner last night because you wanted to look up the recipe for chicken cordon bleu, and where'd you go? You went on Google and typed in chicken cordon bleu. They know where your doctor is because when you needed to cancel the appointment, you didn't bother looking up the phone number. You just went on Google and typed in, Dr. Joe Schmo, oncologist, and voila, now Google knows you have cancer. So, those kinds of things are actually pretty frightening if you really think them through. And the place that I learned about this was when Google made a bet with the Centers for Disease Control that they could detect a flu outbreak before the CDC. And if you'll recall, back around that time, there was this big swine flu fear. Everybody was terrified that this thing was going to wipe us all out. And Google said, well, I know the CDC has a flu map that they put up, but we have even more insight into Americans' health than the Centers for Disease Control. We know more than the federal government. So they had kind of a friendly wager to see who could find the outbreaks faster. And Google created an algorithm that just kind of sat like a spider waiting for people to log on and type in their searches. And if they saw that the combination of searches you typed made it look like you, you know, that gave them the indication that you had the flu, then they, you know, put a red dot on a map. And here's how it would work. You'd be on Google, you'd look up, I don't know, chicken soup or Robitussin or your company's sick leave policy, and they'd go, boom, gotcha, we got a live one. And then they would identify you, of course, because they have your IP address when you're on their website. If you're logged into a Gmail account or a Google Calendar, Google Voice, whatever, they know exactly who you are. They would pinpoint your location, put a red dot on a map, and then after a couple of days of this, they took the map and they went to the CDC and said, here's our map, look, check it out. And the CDC said, well, I'll be dipped. You guys did detect the flu outbreak before we did. It took us a couple more days to even find it. Wow, Google, you really do have your finger on the pulse of America. So when I discovered that, I said, I've got to stop using Google because I, you know, they're not, it's not a one-way street where they're just giving me all the information I want. You know, I mean, think about it. They're not your mom. Why is Google giving you the answer to every question you ever asked? And the answer is because Google is not a search engine. Let me address this saying that they're not a search engine, they're a market research company. Back in the 1980s, I actually got my undergraduate degree in marketing, and this was before the internet. One of my professors told me that one of the toughest things we'd ever have to do would be market research, because people don't want to tell you honestly their true views about things, and they'll hide certain aspects of their lives from market researchers. So imagine if I were to call you up, Rick, and say, hey, I'm with Acme Market Research. Do you have like 20 minutes to answer a bunch of questions? You'd say no. And then even if you did say yes, once I got going on my questions, hey, ever been bankrupt? Got any financial problems? Fighting with your wife? Maybe going through a divorce? Any kind of, you know, bankruptcy? Ever had cancer? What are your health concerns? You know, you'd say, take a hike. Go away. Who are you? So what Google did, recognizing that people don't provide that information voluntarily, is they provided traps, as it were, honey traps, for us to deposit it for them to make their job easy. So if you think about what the Google search engine is, it is a gaping window on the screens of every person in America, every person on the globe, practically, where it says, hey, we're market researchers, deposit your latest thoughts here so we can record them and know more about you. And so you go on there and you've got the you know, you're in your office or your home and you've got the door shut, you think you're alone, and you type your deepest, inmost questions into Google. You know, if a woman has a miscarriage, she's typing that in there. If you're going through, you know, drug addiction, you're typing that in there. If you're going through whatever. So Google exists not to be your best friend and give you every answer under the sun. Google exists truly to be a spy that sits in the middle of your home that collects every thought that you have in passing and gets you to thank them for the privilege. So then you move forward to 2006, and Google in that year came out with Gmail. And I was one of the coalition of privacy groups that signed a coalition letter against Google about Gmail. What Gmail did for the very first time was say, hey, it's free email, just like Hotmail and Yahoo, which had been around for a long time. But this is the free email, quote, unquote, free email, that's going to give you lots of gigabytes of storage. And there's just one little catch. You have to let us read all of your messages. And we wrote a letter and we said, if you do that, you're going to set a dangerous precedent for other companies to follow, and it's going to change the nature of people's understanding of what communications in mail even is, because it's supposed to be private. Well, sure enough, they did it anyway, and now here we are, 7 years later, and you've got not only Google doing that, but now Hotmail, Yahoo, Microsoft, they've all changed their policies now to watch everything that you write. And if you think about it, you know, Google could only get so far knowing everything that crosses your mind in a search. What they then wanted to expand to was knowing everything else about your life. So by having a Gmail window there in which now you're really typing some juicy stuff. I mean, you're like writing to your babysitter, hey, I'm going to be out of town this weekend. I need you here to watch the kids. My kids are Johnny and Julie, and they're 6 and 5, and here's my home address, and here's the number of where we'll be vacationing if you need to reach us. You know, all this kind of really personal details that you would never type into a search engine, but you totally type into email. not only that, you know, I talked to a friend recently. She said, oh, my gosh, Yahoo's doing this, too. I was like, fully Yahoo's doing it probably worse than anybody right now. And she said, well, I just sent my tax return back to my accountant through my Yahoo account as an attachment. Are you telling me Yahoo now knows everything about my income? I said, you better believe it. Their policy plainly states that they will make a copy of every attachment, that they will scan it and perform, quote, content analysis on everything you send or receive to or from a Yahoo account. Gmail does the same thing. Hotmail does the same thing. That's the business they're in. So we, just in response to all of this, when kind of after we stopped the human microchipping, I said, all right, well, now we've got to come up with a way to stop Google. And, of course, I can't stop Google. They're the biggest, you know, one of the biggest corporations on planet Earth. So what I did instead was help to develop an alternative to Google. So since 2009, I have helped to create a search engine called StartPage, which gives you access to Google results without being in the Google microscope. So what happens, you go to startpage.com, you type in your search, we submit it to Google, they never see you, they only see us, we get the Google results, we strip away all their tracking cookies and other garbage, and then we give you those results privately. And then we delete all records of your visit on our website. So no IP address recorded, no tracking cookies. We delete you entirely. So at the end of the day, we have no idea who's been on our website and no idea what they've searched for. So that's our business model. We have ads that are contextual, unlike the ads run through Google and Yahoo and Bing, the spy search engines, where they base the ads on what they saw in your email last week to your brother-in-law. We base it only on the ad for the thing that you're searching for. So kind of like the old days, if you read Field & Stream magazine, the ads in the magazine would be for fishing poles. Well, nowadays, if you look up, you know, Field & Stream magazine, we will give you 1 to 3 ads, or even 0 in some cases, 0 to 3 ads, about fishing poles. So you can click on them, you can not click on them, totally up to you, totally private, startpage.com. And as far as the email situation goes, that has gotten much, much worse in recent weeks. In fact, just this month, the month of June, Yahoo has forced all of its users, some of whom have been with them for 10, 15 years, to, quote, upgrade to a new platform. And when you upgrade to the new Yahoo platform, you agree to allow them to read and scan and perform content analysis on all of your communications. So every email you send from a Yahoo account is automatically copied, read, analyzed, keywords are removed. It goes into their marketing database. But I think more important still, it goes into this NSA database, because as Edward Snowden so heroically has brought to our attention, and may the Lord bless this man, those databases that are being kept by Google and Yahoo and Outlook and AOL and Facebook and all those companies, those are going directly also to the NSA and to the big spy apparatus. So who, you know, if you wanted to know who all of the people are in this country who, for example, supported Ron Paul, and I'm a huge Ron Paul supporter, where would you go? Well, you would go to Google, and you'd see who was typing in that kind of stuff and emailing their friends, and, hey, I'll be at the Ron Paul rally tonight. Are you coming too? You would go to these internet companies to identify your political enemies. So it's no surprise that we had the big Tea Party IRS scandal right on the heels of all of this, or right before all of this, because that's exactly what this kind of information makes possible. You identify your political enemies, you identify the people who oppose your corrupt power, and then you go after them. And whether you go after them with an IRS audit, which is a pretty nasty thing if you've ever been through one, or whether you go after them by locking them up and throwing them in the gulag or in a concentration camp, you know, it's a matter of degree. It's not a matter of, you know, it's an issue of degree, not kind. And I think if we're not careful, we're going to be heading in that direction, because that's where this kind of snooping and totalitarian top-down control always winds up. So there it is in a nutshell.
Wow, Doctor, there are so many areas I'd like to pursue. Let me go back to the beginning, and if this is not an area that you remain focused on, just wave me off, and I'm fine with that. But, you know, you raise a point right at the beginning when you talked about your opposition to the coupon cards or the savings cards at the grocery stores and the pharmacies. We all see these things. Many of us use these things because they do provide a modest economic incentive for you to participate in this problem, in this program. One of the questions I had, and I've never seen it addressed, and maybe you know about this, is obviously beyond the, you know, the Winn-Dixie or the Publix or the Piggly Wiggly or whatever the particular vendor is, that data is being aggregated by whom? Do we know that? Do we know who else is getting that besides obviously the government? But are there?
Well, the government actually may or may not be getting that information. That's an interesting question. We know people do not understand what happens when they scan the frequent shopper card. And we did a bunch of research back in 2000 and 2001 looking into, do they really save you money? And, in fact, I did a research with the Wall Street Journal. I did another one with the CBS in Boston. And we did a number of price comparisons around the country on the stores that do and don't have the cards. And what we found was, first of all, stores with cards on average have much higher prices than stores without cards. So there's the first thing, that even when you take advantage of the card sales, you're still paying more money than you would pay just by going down the street and buying things on sale at the card-free store. But the other thing that we discovered in doing all of our research into these shopper cards is that the reason there's two reasons they offer the cards. Number one, they want a record of everything you buy. And they want to be able to identify who buys what so that they can do some things I can tell you about in a minute. But the second reason that they do this is because what it does is it takes the sale prices and makes them not available to the 10 to 20% of people who don't scan the card. So there's a huge financial incentive. It's basically a form of screwage against the people who don't have a card. What people don't realize, your supermarket is not who drives the sales. If you see, you know, Häagen-Dazs ice cream, or that's not a good example, Breyers ice cream is a good example because I actually saw this. If you see Breyers ice cream and it's on sale for $3 for a quart instead of its usual $6 for a quart, then you say, oh, wow, my supermarket is giving me a great deal. But that's not the case. Breyers ice cream would be on sale because the Breyers Corporation itself or the wholesaler, the distributor who gets it to the store, wants to put it on sale. And they might do that for a bunch of reasons. They might do it because it's the month of January. They're not selling a lot of ice cream, but they know little Timmy has a birthday party, and they want you to buy their brand. So when the summer rolls around and you're buying ice cream, Breyers will be your brand of choice. They might do it because they've got an overstock. There's just too darn much ice cream in the warehouse, and they want to move it out. So at that point, they'll put it on sale. Or it might just be part of a promotional thing so that they can increase their market share for this quarter, for example. So for all those reasons, what happens is Breyers says to all of the supermarkets that carry its brand, hey, listen, for the month of June, we're going to put all of our ice cream at a discounted price of, instead of $6, it's going to be $3. And so we're going to make it available to you for, I don't know, $2.50, however they do that with their markup, and you put it on the shelf at $3. Thank you. All right, well, the stores that don't have cards just put the ice cream on the shelf at $3, and then they run an ad, and you get the flyer with your newspaper that says, ice cream on sale, $3, come shop at, you know, Groceries R Us, whatever. The stores that have a card, though, they only make that discounted price available to the 85 or so percent of people who scan the card. So when you go into Safeway or Kroger or any of these other stores that have the card, then you'll see, oh, it's $3 with card. But if you don't scan your card, they charge you the full whopping $6. And so they are making $3.50 off of those people who don't scan the card, whereas they would only normally make 50 cents off of the people if they didn't have the card. So you can already see right there, there's a huge economic incentive for them to basically perform screwage on the people who do not have a card. And, you know, you would think that the people who don't have cards are, you know, maybe they're so wealthy they send their maids to the grocery store to do their shopping. But, and I used to think that too until one day I was standing at, I was doing a protest in Seattle. And I was standing in line, actually just kind of trying to observe how the store was working. And this guy in front of me, this old guy who can barely walk, you know, probably in his 80s, he comes up to the counter and he puts like, I don't know, it was like three pieces of fruit on the counter. And this 18-year-old, you know, she scans it, she's all bright and cheery. Do you have your, what was it, I'm trying to remember the name of it. It was a Kroger brand. So do you have your Kroger card? And this guy just looks at her and doesn't even understand what she's saying. He's like adjusting his hearing aid. He's like, what? My what? You know, your Kroger's card, your frequent shopper card. Anyway, long story short, she rings it up. It comes to like $6.
Oh, my God.
$6 for like three little pieces of fruit. And this guy is pulling out his wallet to pay it. And finally, the lady behind him, I watched this whole thing happen. The lady behind him says, oh, my gosh, give him my card. She hands her card. They scan it through, and it goes down to like $1.50. So that's the kind of people that they're taking advantage of, the people who don't speak English, the people who are too old or frail or feeble to understand, disabled people, people who are traveling from out of town, people who are in a hurry, moms who are in a rush and don't have the time to, you know, dig the card out. That's who they're taking advantage of. So right there, there's an economic problem with these cards, I believe, that we should not have two-tiered pricing systems in this country. If there's a sale, it should be democratically available to all people. And I, you know, as a free market libertarian, I don't believe the government should impose that, but I believe that we shoppers should demand that. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is, what do they do with the data? So they have the cards because, number one, they can basically rip people off who don't have it. And then, number two, they have them because they want to collect your shopping data. So by having these cards, it enables them to know every single stick of broccoli and pint of Haagen-Dazs and thing of ground beef that your family has consumed. And what they're doing now, and this is, you know, if you think about it, it's not surprising, although it'll kind of shock you, they have converted every object in the supermarket into a detailed nutritional breakdown. And so they know down to the last gram of fat and sodium exactly how your family is eating. So who has an interest in that? Insurance companies and federal health agencies. And both of them have expressed an interest in getting that data. And in fact, up here where I live in New England, the biggest grocery chain up here is called Stop and Shop. And they've actually I have it on tape, that they said that they were sharing the shopper card data with HMOs. So your HMO can take a look there and decide whether to cancel your policy, raise your rates, deny you coverage, you know, do whatever they want to do based on not liking how you eat. And you can say, well, you know, I guess that's Stop and Shop and that's my HMO, but, you know, when the federal government gets in charge, then you've really got an issue. Because right now, under the British national healthcare system, the Brits are accessing shopper card data in a trial with Tesco, the biggest supermarket over there in the UK. And they are combing through people's shopper card records to find people whose purchases make them look like fat slobs. And now they're trying to manipulate those people into making different purchasing decisions and eating differently. So already the national health people are combing through this data. And I believe it's just a matter of time here in the U.S. once we have Obamacare in full swing and we're paying for one another's health care, for people to begin saying, you know, you're not allowed to just eat nothing but potato chips and soda all day long, because you're going to make yourself sick doing that. I'm going to have to pay for it. So I think it's a matter of time before the government starts using, and the private corporations and the insurance companies start using those shopper cards in order to ration certain foods, in order to restrict certain people against purchasing certain kinds of foods, in order to raise the rates on people who don't eat in ways that are approved. And I think ultimately what's going to happen is what's happening right now in Venezuela, where 65 supermarkets are all in league with frequent shopper cards to restrict the amount of food that Venezuelans can buy. So in Venezuela, they've got this horrible problem where price controls have led to food shortages. Well, price controls always lead to shortages. You know, repeat after me. They always lead price controls lead to shortages. So in Venezuela, which Hugo Chavez was in charge trying to create his socialist utopia there, and the only result is now they ran it completely out of toilet paper. The whole nation had no toilet paper a couple of weeks ago, and they're out of food. So what they're doing is they're using the frequent shopper card infrastructure put in place in all their grocery stores, just like here in the U.S., to say, now in order to buy food, you have to scan your government ID. And, you know, we've got the scanner right here. It's been in use for the last 10 years for the stupid frequent shopper card. So now we just re-rigged it. So now you scan your driver's license. And when you scan it, we make a record. Oh, you bought a gallon of milk. And you have a family of how many? Oh, yeah, that's right. You have three kids. So you're allowed 2 gallons of milk every 2 weeks. And so you buy it at grocery store A, and then you go across town 5 days later to grocery store B, and you try to buy a gallon of milk, And when you get to the cash register and you scan your driver's license, it goes, bah, nope, sorry, got to put it back on the shelf. You've exceeded your quota. So it's rationing is what it is.
Yeah.
We're going to see the same thing here, whether it's because of a shortage, whether it's because of health reasons, whatever, you're going to see the same thing here. And we stupidly have allowed this infrastructure to be built by not opposing these cards when we should have.
I was involved in the, I've been in the internet business for a long time. And in the late 90s, I was at a conference and they were touting some of the new products that were being rolled out. And there was a product rolled out that it actually stopped me in my tracks. I've been a technologist and an early adopter for a long time. The thing that struck me, and the thing that I thought that no one was quite getting the impact of, was here was the argument. In those days, through the 70s and the 80s and even most of the 90s, databases, because they were all so idiosyncratically designed, each one was kind of different, whether it be in a different software platform or a different format. The tables, the data didn't quite align, and there was a great degree of incompatibility. The driver's license information didn't track with the auto tag agency, which didn't track with your voting information. And consequently, all of these databases existed in their own informational space. But what I saw happening was several companies came out with software that said, wait a minute, that's not a problem. We can rig it so that your criminal control information database, your driver's license control information database, your auto tag information, this, that, the other thing, there are new database tools coming out back then that allowed all these databases to talk together. And I thought, oh my God, what this is going to do is create what we're seeing right now is an informational space where every controlling entity can cross-reference any data whatsoever, whether it be what food you're buying, where you're getting gas, what toll booth you went through, where your kids go to school, how many times you voted, what you bought at the drugstore, and the potential for misuse is just tremendous. Another thing I wanted to ask you before we got too far away from your earlier comments was the RFID embedding, which is now being done on animals basically without thought. No one seems to get the ultimate impact of that. And another avenue that I've heard of recently is what they're calling GPS dust. Have you heard of that?
I've heard it called by different names. You can call it smart dust or RFID dust.
Sure.
Spray on RFID antennas. There's a lot of ways to track things. Unfortunately, I'm looking at the clock, and I've actually got another appointment I need to run to. But I know it can be discouraging to hear all of this, so I wanted to give people hope with some of the alternative products that we've helped to put out there.
Please do.
Startpage.com. As an alternative to Google, you can add it to your homepage right there at startpage.com. There's a little link there where you can add it to your browser. So instead of having the Google window in the upper corner, you've got the start page window. And one of the things that I'm trying to get all of the radio hosts, and Rick, I would appreciate if you think about this too, for us to all stop saying Google it. You know, Google the pandemic.
Oh, I never do that.
Google my next guest. Yeah, it took me, even after I had created Start Page, it took me a couple of months to stop saying Google, if you can believe it. It's such a part of the language, and I think we all have to just stop saying Google this, Google that. It is not a verb. It's a multinational corporation in league with the NSA that is spying on Americans, and we need to stop giving them free advertising by mentioning their name all day long. And around these parts, we say Start Page it, just to encourage people, and they go, what's that? What do you mean Start Page it? And it opens up the conversation, and you can inform them about what Google is doing. The other thing I wanted to mention, Rick, here before I go, is
Please.
That on the email portion, the Gmail, Yahoo, and Hotmail part of this, I've been working for the last 2 years to create a private alternative to those with the good folks at StartPage. So we have a new mail program coming out this fall. It's called StartMail, StartMail, just like it sounds, startmail.com. And what we're doing is we've put together basically the email that we never read. We make an ironclad promise that we never read it, and you don't have to take our word for it, because we've built the infrastructure so that we can't read it. Your email sits on a user vault that cannot be accessed by anyone unless they have your PGP password to decrypt the vault. And that sounds complicated, but we've made it so easy that a 10-year-old could use it, but it is so powerful that even the most brilliant of hackers would not be able to get into it. So that's at startmail.com. It will not be free, because the Gmail accounts and Yahoo accounts, those aren't free either. They're basically giving you the equivalent of a Starbucks cup of coffee every month to let you read all of your email, which is about $5. So our service is going to be worth about, it's going to cost but somewhere between $5 and $10 a month. It's coming out later this fall. And if listeners to this radio program would like to get in on the ground floor of StartMail, they can go to startmail.com. They can sign up to be on our mailing list to get the first announcement when it comes out. And if they check the little box that says beta, then they can actually get a free trial account to kick the tires if they're willing to give us some feedback on the program and be beta testers. They
I've already signed up.
Awesome. Thank you. So, and in fact, Rick, if you'd like, if you want to drop me a line, or we could talk off air here, if you let me know what name you would like, I can go ahead and reserve your name for you, and we'll go ahead and give you a free full-year account. So I would love to make that available to you, because I think we in the liberty movement, privacy people, media people, we've got to really think about how to get out of these other systems and really get privacy for our communications, because, you know, we're the only thing standing between, you know, the people and tyranny. It's the media and the activists and the people on the front lines. And I know you're one of them, and we want you to have free, protected, complete private email so that you can do what you do best.
I've been recommending to my students and clients ixquick.com for years. And
There you go. I didn't even mention that, did I? ixquick.com. Can I tell you the difference between ixquick and StartPage?
Please do.
Yeah, so ixquick has been around since 1999. It is, we call them both the world's most private search engines. ixquick gives you results from search engines that do not include Google. And StartPage gives you only Google results. So you can really choose whether you want actually, you know, some people just want Google results. They like the quality of the results, but they don't like the tracking. So startpage.com is where you would get those. When you get there, you'll see powered by Google, but don't let it freak you out. We have no relationship with Google other than the ability to put their logo on there to tell you that we're really giving you real Google results, but they never see you. We never share any data with them. We're not owned by them. They don't invest in us. We don't invest in them. They're a separate company, and in fact, we're kind of at odds with one another on occasion. So startpage.com, 100% Google results, 100% privacy. ixquick or ixquick.com, 100% privacy, no Google. And then startmail.com, the new private email coming out.
Can I ask you one quick last easy question?
Absolutely.
I would imagine there'd be quite a bit of federal pressure that your information should be available.
You're going to love the answer. You're going to love the answer. We are not based in the U.S. We're based in the Netherlands. I'm a true blue American gal. I buy American every time I can. But this is one time, and I got to say, especially in light of this NSA spying revelations and what Ed Snowden has told us, this is one time I'm really, really glad to be doing business with a country, with a company that's not under U.S. jurisdiction. StartPage and StartMail and ixquick, the parent company, is based in the Netherlands. It's family owned by good Christian people. They're wonderful people. I know them personally. They are not subject to the Patriot Act. They are not subject to any U.S. courts or warrants or U.S. orders. They're not subject to any NSA or FBI demands. They're not subject to a PRISM program because they're not under U.S. jurisdiction. So it would take a lot. And, you know, I love the fact that they're Dutch, because the Dutch people, you know about Amsterdam and the red light district, they've got free pot smoking and prostitution is legal. I mean, it's kind of crazy over there, but what it means is that they take privacy really seriously.
Yeah.
They're probably, arguably, the most private country on planet Earth, and their courts, that filters all the way through their courts, their justice system, their government, that they really hold people's privacy up as one of their highest values to defend. And so, you know, you would have to get, if the Patriot Act or somebody in the U.S. wanted to get access to any records, they would have to go through a Dutch court. And even then, if the Dutch court compelled us to turn something over, we'd say, fine, we don't even have any records.
Yeah, that's the beauty of your system.
People who search. It's wonderful. So, yeah, you want records? Here you go. There's nothing in them. And then on Start Mail, we would say, you know, you want access? We can't give it to you because we can't get in. If you want to get a hold of Rick's email, you got to go to Rick and get him to give you the password and let you in. He's got the key. Don't look at us. And, you know, I had somebody ask me this morning, doesn't that mean that you're just going to be supporting criminals? No, it means that the law-abiding people of this planet will have a place to go and write their email without being snooped on by the government, which is what the Fourth Amendment was all about to begin with.
Back when it existed.
And when people say, couldn't criminals abuse you? We say, I am not a law enforcement agent. I'm not a private investigator. It is not my job to solve crime. It is my job to provide email and search products for people. It is the government's job to solve crime. And if they want to solve crime, they've got plenty of methods to do it. If they believe that you're committing a crime, they can go to you and they can get you to tell their information. But we're not in the business of sitting around all day long collecting data on people in the off chance that they might commit a crime. And that kind of mentality is exactly how you wind up with this hideous NSA thing where everybody's being spied on all the time. And that's what we got to put an end to. So we're not participating in it. We want nothing to do with it. It's the wrong kind of mindset to have a free planet.
Well, thank you so very much, Dr. Albrecht. We really appreciate you coming on. And I hope you'll come out again, especially when you can talk up the release of the public version of Start Mail. Looking forward to it very much.
Oh, it's going to be so great. Thank you, Richard. God bless you. Thanks so much for having me
on
the
show. And you
too. I can't wait to come back and actually say, it's live, and here's your account. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks again. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
That was Dr. Catherine Albrecht from Start Mail. And before we bring in our final guest, Democratic candidate for governor, I have this brief commercial to play for our sponsor.
What is Legal Shield? It's total access. It's total freedom. Everyone deserves legal protection. And now, with Legal Shield, everyone can access it. No matter how traumatic, no matter how trivial, whatever your situation is, we are there to help. From real estate to divorce advice, identity theft, and beyond. Legal Shield has your rights covered. With Legal Shield, you'll be able to talk to a dedicated, experienced attorney about whatever you want, as often as you want, for less than $20 a month, no matter what happens. Legal Shield will have you protected and empowered to worry less and live more. Please visit www.mrsdd.com. That's www.mrsdd.com. Legal Shield.
Okay, and we have our final and featured guest in the show, Saluting Progressive Women, gubernatorial candidate Nan Rich. Nan, are you with us?
I am with you. Good evening.
Wonderful.
Nice to be here.
I have just a brief introduction I want to give to our listeners, and then I want to turn it over to you. Nan is one of the most passionate and dedicated members of the Florida Senate, first elected to the State Senate in 2004 after serving in the House of Representatives from 2000 to 2004. She served as leader of the Senate Democratic Caucus from 2010 to 2012 and was term limited in November of 2012. Senator Rich is widely recognized as one of Florida's leading champions of children's and social justice issues. She served on numerous Senate committees, including Health and Human Services, Appropriations, Vice Chair, Children, Family, and Elder Affairs, Vice Chair, Regulated Industries, Reapportionment, Environmental Preservation and Conservation, and the Joint Legislative Budget Committee. Nan, thank you so much for joining us. That is quite an impressive array of credentials you bring to this race. Why don't you tell us a little bit about where you are in the race, where you're going, what the issues are, and
okay.
You can take it from there.
All right, great. I'll be very happy to, and thank you for asking me to be on this evening. Well, you gave my kind of my legislative background, and that's just a part of the experience that I would bring to this job of governor. I spent many years as a community activist in South Florida before being elected to the legislature. So, I think I bring a pretty good background, as you mentioned, of issues and understanding of the legislative process, which I think is extremely important. And as we can see from what is happening in this administration, it is very important for the governor to actually understand the legislative process and how government works. I think what I would want to say is that in November 2014, the voters will choose who will lead our state for the next 4 years. And I believe from what I have been doing, and you asked what have I been doing in my campaign? Well, for a year, I basically have been traveling all across the state of Florida. I have had over 200 visits in communities from the Panhandle down to the Keys, from the East Coast to the West Coast. And there's really a chorus of voices, of voters and activists who are committed to moving Florida in a new direction and with new leadership. I think they share, my feeling that we need to have different priorities and a different direction. And I guess I would say I have a different vision for the state of Florida than the current governor and leadership. In 2010, when Rick Scott ran, he had a slogan, "Let's get to work." That was his theme. But I think we didn't quite know what that meant. And now, after 3 years of this administration, it's very clear what they meant. And by that I mean that they worked hard, but they worked hard in the opposite direction, I think, of what most Floridians had in mind. They worked harder to make it. They worked hard to make it harder for people to vote. They worked to undermine and really to destroy public education. They certainly worked to restrict women's reproductive rights. And lastly, I mean, they worked very hard to block Floridians from the benefits of the Affordable Care Act from Obamacare. And none of these things created even a single job, and that's what the governor ran on, was let's get to work, let's have jobs. But really what happened is, as I said, all of these things did not create jobs. They actually caused jobs to be lost, and particularly in healthcare and education, in the healthcare and education arena.
Senator Rick.
Yeah, sure.
Richard Spisak.
Hi, Richard.
You know, you have shown your leadership in the legislature and in this state for years. You're an experienced leader. You're the first Democrat to come out and declare yourself. When you get the Florida governorship, what can you tick off your, say, top three priority items?
Well, I would tell you that overall, I guess you could say jobs in the economy, but I would say that a critical part of that has to do with education and healthcare. As I mentioned, education and healthcare are the real economic engines in our state, and yet this administration has cut in those areas. So when I get to be the governor, the number one thing I would do would be to focus on education in the state of Florida, and by that I mean a whole continuum of education, starting with childcare, the foundation, so that when kids come to school, they are ready, and they're ready to succeed in school. We are not having that today because we are giving short shrift to both quality childcare and quality universal pre-K, which was voted on by the voters of this state. If you look at our VPK program, you know, we spend $2,382 a child for an entire year for quality pre-K. You can't buy that You can't buy quality child care for that amount of money. The average in the United States is $4,100. And we are one of the states that only meet three benchmarks. We don't even have a goal of degreed teachers. So if you start there and then go to your K to 12, where we have such an over-reliance on high-stakes testing, then and of course, the funding issue as well. Then you go to higher ed, where we're 50th in the nation in funding of higher ed. And yet we were able last year to cut, the governor signed a budget that cut $300 million from higher ed. As a matter of fact, lastly on this issue of education, the Pew Foundation came in and did a study of the economic incentive program that Florida has, which I have been very distressed with over my years, especially serving on the Legislative Budget Commission, where we give money hand over fist to companies and have no accountability or transparency, and they can claim that they are going to create three jobs, and yet they only create one job. And the Pew Foundation said we ought to be investing that money in higher education because that's the true economic engine. So education is, to me, you know, it's the foundation. It's the path to prosperity for, you know, for young people and certainly for economic development in the state of Florida. So that would be, you know, number one. And, of course, equally as important would be health care. When I look at what this legislature and governor did by not passing legislation to draw down $51 billion in Medicaid expansion money that would insure over a million Floridians, it's unconscionable. And when you look again at jobs, this jobs, according to the University of Florida, 120,000 jobs would be created in that 10-year period where we draw down the $51 billion from the federal government. Those are our tax dollars. We deserve to get them in our state. We deserve, our Floridians deserve to be insured with that money. And we, at this point, have no mechanism to take that money and use it for health care for Floridians. And when you think about all those jobs, those are good paying jobs. Those are health care jobs because if you add over a million people to your roles, your health care roles, you need more health care providers. So these are two areas that I believe that it's kind of the crux of the economic development in this state has to do with both education and health care. And by the way, lastly, with the Medicaid expansion, you know, our businesses are going to get hit tremendously because if we do not do the Medicaid expansion, they will have to come up with either providing health care or paying the penalty of up to $3,000 per employee for those employees that are required for them to cover. And in addition to that, our hospitals are going to be devastated by the fact that the subsidies to them go away for uninsured, and if you don't have the money to draw down for the Medicaid expansion, there is no way to cover all the uninsured people that come to the hospitals, particularly our safety net hospitals like Jackson and Shands and our children's hospitals that have over 70% Medicaid patients. So, you know, those are kind of the areas that I think we need to have, you know, those need to be the priorities. And for me, it's all kind of about putting people first in both the educational arena and the healthcare arena.
I guess it's safe to assume then that privatization of state resources may not be a high priority for you.
No, actually, it's a very low. It's a very low priority. Whether it's prison privatization or whether it's the attempt, as was made in 2012 when I was the leader, to privatize part of our public education system by passing the parent trigger bill. You know, that bill would have allowed for-profit management companies to come in and take over public schools. And, you know, schools need better resources. They need involved parents. They need good teachers. They need a supportive community. But they don't need for-profit management companies to come in and take them over. And the interesting thing to me about that whole debate is the parent trigger bill was basically titled the Parent Empowerment Act. So if it's the Parent Empowerment Act, I would wonder why not one single parent group in the state of Florida, starting with the PTA, going to Parents Across America, Fund Education Now, 50th No More, all of these groups were opposed to this legislation. and they were opposed to the legislation because they know that it's very misleading and it doesn't empower parents. It does exactly the opposite.
Well, that's one thing our current governor is good at, misleading people. Senator Rich, let me ask you, as you know, Florida has been an embarrassment when it comes to voting. Voting rights in this state have been under attack under the current administration. What would your administration do differently?
Well, let me say that, first of all, I would never have signed a piece of legislation like the governor signed in 2011, which was the voter suppression law, or as we called it, the Voter Suppression Act, which reduced early voting, which said that many Democratic groups of voters had barriers placed in front of them, particularly people like college students who go to their polling place at their university and they haven't changed their address. And previously they didn't have to. They would just show their voter registration card. And because we have an electronic database, there's no reason why someone shouldn't be able to change their address, you know, that day and not have to vote a provisional ballot. And, of course, that was not corrected in the bill that was passed this year. And interestingly enough, the governor in 2011, after the election went south in 2012, he said he wanted to find out what happened. Well, what happened is you signed that bill. That's number one. And then the legislation that was passed this past year, in my opinion, really does not fix things. So first of all, it doesn't mandate the 14 days of early voting. What it does is let the supervisor of elections in each county make that determination. So they mandate the 8 days, a certain number of hours, but the 14 days and the souls to the polls, the Sunday before election, is up to the individual supervisor. Well, to me, that's an equal access issue. Why in Broward County, for instance, now you know that Brenda Snipes, the supervisor of election, is going to have 14 days of early voting and she's going to have the souls to the polls. So will many others, but then there will be many other counties who will not do it. And
right.
So it seems to me that that is, as I said, an equal access issue. Everybody should, there should be the same requirement statewide for people for early voting, for the hours. I also believe there should be, and I had a bill to the effect of this several years ago, that said that the number of early voting sites, the number of voters at early voting sites should be the same, because the bill said something like 63,000 per early voting site, because I don't know if you recall, but the first year we had early voting, we had many sites in Miami-Dade County, and Duval County had one. So again, you get there's a certain segment of the population that does not have the same access that some other part of the population has, and that's, not right as far as I'm concerned in having, fair and equal voting rights.
Right. As a related question to this, I'm sure you're aware of the League of Women Voters work on trying to change the redistricting in Florida. Where are you on this issue?
Well, I was the Senate Democratic leader, and I worked very hard because I was one of those people, and as were many of my colleagues. They worked very hard to help pass the Fair Districts Amendments. And unfortunately, I don't think that the plan that was put in place is one that really follows what the amendments are supposed to accomplish. And so there are still lawsuits going on, and I think some of the districts are gerrymandered and favor the party in power. And I think that we'll have to see where those lawsuits go. But I don't think that the fair districts were implemented the way the voters intended.
Would you favor an impartial commission for redistricting in the future?
I actually had favored that a number of years ago when that was one of the possibilities. And I certainly would give that great consideration. I think it has worked in other states. And, of course, I mean, now we have the fair districts, and if we could get that implemented the way the voters intended, I think it probably would work pretty well. But as it is now, we still have gerrymandered districts.
Unfortunately, yeah.
Unfortunately, yes.
Senator, I've got a question for you. You know, you're a person who's been committed to the welfare of children, whether they be abused or handicapped or just in need of good quality education, for your entire professional career. You know, there are those who have recently turned to the Democratic Party. You know, you bring a depth of experience, a seriousness on the children and education front that no one can compare to.
Well, thank you. I happen to agree with you. you know, I'm a lifelong Democrat, and long before I got to the legislature, as I mentioned, I was a community activist involved in helping to start many programs aimed at making sure that children were able to reach their full potential, whether it was through you know, quality childcare, early education, quality public education. Having a child welfare system where children were protected, not put in jeopardy, as we have had in the past number of weeks, where we have had four children die in the child welfare system. You know, I just think, again, it shows that the priorities, that most of the people with whom I have met around this state, the priorities that they believe are the ones that we should be focusing on, are not the ones that this administration has as their priorities. So, I think we need to bring someone in as governor who shares the priorities with the people. And, you know, the Democrats in particular, I think, believe, as I mentioned, in putting the needs of people first, whether it's children, whether it's people with developmental disabilities, you know, whether it's having a strong public education system, making sure that we have equal rights, individual rights that are protected for all people, whether it's, gender, age, race, sexual orientation. I kind of look at people who have jumped on board lately as polls begin to change, you know, with issues relating to the GLBT community. And I'm proud to say that that fairness and equality is something that has been a part of, my values and my priorities, for my entire public service. And I believe that those are the rights we should fight for. I've done that as a state rep, as a state senator, and, certainly as the first woman leader of the Senate Democratic Caucus, and I really, plan on doing that as the first woman governor.
Well, many of us in Florida stand with you. I've heard you referred to as a little lion defending Florida and Florida's children. So we're depending on you to make that good fight. Good luck.
Yeah. Thank you so much, and thank you for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Well, we hope that you'll come back and celebrate your
Anytime.
Nomination with us.
Yep.
And,
thank you. I'll be happy to do that.
Senator Rich, could you tell us how our listeners can find out more about you and if you have any events coming up?
Well, they can go on to my website, that's www.nanrich2014.com. And we have different events around the state that we have begun putting up so that people can see where we will be next. I've had this terrific Facebook page, which is people say to me, oh, my goodness, it's like a travel log. You've been everywhere. But the problem with that was that they didn't know where I was going ahead of time. So now we're putting those calendar things up so that people can, see where I'm going. And I, certainly would love to have people who share these Democratic values and principles. We want them all to be a part of this campaign, and I really believe that we can take this state back and put people first.
Thank you so much, Senator.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank
and
you.
You've got strong support from us, so if we can help you, just let us know.
Thank you. Thanks so much. I appreciate it. Good night.
Okay, and you have a good night, Senator.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Renee, I know you have a story for us. Give us a short one, and then we'll be doing our salute to our colleagues.
Okay, give me a second here. I'm a little off guard.
While she's pulling those notes together, let me say we want you to tune in also to our good colleagues, Gwen Holden-Berry and her show, Here Be Monsters, Brian Stetton and his show, Progress Toward Democracy, Anita Stewart and her show, Wise Women Media, Susan Nylon and the Nylon Report, and Sita Baguil and Sita Media. Renee, take it away.
Well, there's two things here, one of which we don't have time for, but in the latest issue of The Nation magazine, there is a terrific article on privacy, and it basically goes into what the government has been doing up until now and how their promises of trust us cannot be taken at face value. And the other one is on the voting rights. There was a good editorial today in the New York Times about the strike down of Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act. And as we know, that is the formula that determine which states have to get justice approval pre-clearance for any changes in their voting process, be it redistricting or voter poll places and so on. And the editorial is really good because it points out ways that the Voting Rights Act can still be used to affect. Now, obviously, we're not going to get congressional support anytime soon for an update of that formula, given the Republican intransigence in Congress. But if I could just mention, the department can still use Section 3 of the Act to get states or cities back into its jurisdiction, allowing it to judge election changes. To do so, most must show clear intent of racial discrimination, which is easy to hide. Congress should revise that section to allow coverage when a state makes a voting change with disparate racial impact, not just discriminatory impact. There's also Section 2 of the Act, which gives the department or private citizens the right to sue any local or state government for an improper election practice. These kinds of legal actions, though expensive and difficult, are likely to become the principal tool for enforcing voting rights, and the department needs to gear up to fight many more of them. As we know from our experience right here in Florida, it was the action of a lot of private lawsuits that tried to keep at bay the changes that our governor was making to the voting rights and voting practices here in Florida. So although it has been greatly weakened, I think we can salvage something out of this until Congress can take up the issue of changing the formula. And that's it.
Well, thank you so much. I do want to remind our listeners that our good friends at the Sierra Club are hoping that you'll send them pictures of slime and algae in your local canals and lagoons. We had a report last week on the tremendous pollution problems up in the Indian River Lagoon, and we know that you want to help. So give the good people at Sierra Club the chance to use the information that you're collecting and you can collect in your local areas. Also, we want to mention that next week our show is going to be on voting rights. We've got some wonderful guests coming up. Our good Congressman Patrick Murphy, candidate Corey Westbrook, and a very interesting story from North Florida. We'll keep you guessing on that. And also, we're hoping to have our good friend Luis Cuevas come on. He's always a font of information from Progressive Push. So thank you, Renee.
Thank you, Rick.
And thank you all for joining us. It's been a wonderful show tonight. We had some great guests, and we'll hope to talk to you next week. And all I do want to say is... And there we go. Give peace a chance, friends. See you next week when Progressive News Network brings you Renee and Rick and some wonderful guests talking about voting rights. So we'll talk to you next week.
I don't want your millions, mister. While you enjoyed a life of ease, you've stolen all that we built, mister. Now our children starve and freeze. So I don't want your millions, mister. I don't want your diamond. Call me green or blue or red. This one thing I sure know, mister. My hungry babies must be fed. Take the two old parties, mister. No different in them I can see. But with a farmer labor party, we could set the people free. So I don't want your millions, mister. I don't want your diamond ring. All I want is the right to live, mister. Give me back.